it's always very exciting to look for them. When you go to, as a biologist, you go to areas where nobody has been before, no scientist, and you're looking for amphibians and reptiles and anything you find there can potentially be new, yeah? As it was during my last expeditions to Peru.
You've named this one Attenborough's rubber frog. Why?
Why does somebody not want to name a species after Sir David Attenborough? It's such a fascinating and admirable person. He has done so much for biology. The movies that are well known among the population, among students. I frequently use his movies in class. And he has done very good movies about frogs and pointed out their critical situation in the world. I saw his interview when he turned 90 years old. I was wondering, I should name a frog after him. Then I was looking into databases and realized that not a single amphibian species has been named after Attenborough, and I thought with my colleague we should change this.
That's a little bit of an oversight, considering that he likes amphibians.
So. Yeah, exactly. So I was expecting that there are maybe others named species after him, but not there. Of course, I think 16 species that have been named after him, and now 17. With his frog added.
What did he say when you asked him?
He was thrilled. I sent a letter to him asking him for permission, what one normally should do when dedicating a species after a living person, to ask for permission, because you don't want to insult a person. Yeah? Imagine somebody has a phobia against frogs and you name a frog after this person. It would not be good, obviously.
Not good, no.
I introduced shortly myself to him and my colleague, a photo of the frog where we discovered it and asking for the permission to name it. And we gave the name, how it would be called to him. And now, a little bit more than a week, I got a letter back from him with a personal note saying that he's thrilled and he likes the idea, gave us permission to do so.
Yeah. Why rubber frog?
I have actually no idea, but this is the common popular term for this genus. I have no idea who came up with this with this name rubber.
Let's talk about the frog itself. What does it look like, and how did you know right away that it was different?
Definitely, I have a lot of experience in the high elevation, the Andes, working in Peru, so I have an idea how the known species look. Yeah, and this was something where nobody has been before, and it looked totally different. Yeah, so it was immediately clear that we have found a new species.
What you may consider totally different and what I or any other layperson may consider totally different could be different things. Yeah. What do you mean?
For me, it's like the experience, it's like the size, a combination of characters such as the size, about 2 centimeters long, then the coloration, dark brown, greenish, gray, and where it lived. Yeah, very, very isolated area. Yeah, so it was clear.
I was struggling through the paper, and there was a description of supratympanic striping that was also distinctive. I'm guessing that has something to do with stripes over its ear pits.
Yeah, exactly. These are kind of standard terminology. I agree with you that reading such papers is not very entertaining. Yeah, these are working papers that one needs when he describes other species to compare it with. But these are kind of standard characters, and the format is standard that is used by scientists for the purpose in describing frogs.
What makes it different from other similar types of genuses or species?
Genus is more difficult. Actually, we thought when we found it that it would belong to a different genus that also is restricted in northern and central Peru at high elevations, and had all the character, morphological character combinations with the Andes frogs. Yeah, and so then we were surprised when my colleague, Dr. Von Mai at the University of Michigan, conducted a genetic research, a phylogeny, an evolutionary tree, and it was revealed in this tree that this frog is actually part of a different genus.
Yeah. Which one?
Pristimantis, where we kind of placed it in then. Yeah? So you can see how different sets of characters are important to diagnose and identify species.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Edgar Layer, a biologist at Illinois Wesleyan University, who has discovered a new frog in the high Andes of Peru. When you found out that it was of a different genus than you thought it might be, does that suggest anything about the genus that you thought it might be in the first place?
Exactly. So we commented on this, that researchers have to be very careful by just using morphological character combinations because it can be totally misleading. Yeah, this is a sign that different character character combinations have evolved convergently, yeah, without reflecting relationships in the Andes among frogs. Yeah, now we are looking into the genus where we wanted to place this frog at the beginning to see if there are other frogs that maybe are misplaced in this genus, and we have so far have found one potential candidate to which this frog that we described is very similar to.
But if it's not misplaced and there is convergent evolution, yeah, what does that say about the Andes that produces these yeah kinds of characteristics, whether yeah it's the webbing on the toes or the way the head looks or the jaw looks or the ear locations look like?
Exactly. This is another very interesting research topic to look how an environment kind of shapes an organism that lives in this. Yeah, we cannot only see this within the Andes of Peru. There are similar cases in the mountains of Philippines or the Himalayas, that the character, the factors of environment, climatic conditions, kind of shape the morphology of organisms that then appear to look similar without being related to each other.
So what about the Andes produces this?
Oh, the Andes are known to be a hot spot for biodiversity. I spent this year, it's 20 years that I do research in Peru, and it never gets boring. I mean, you have to go to an isolated area, and you will, if you do a good job, if you're committed to field work, yeah, then you can find organisms, yeah, reptiles, amphibians that nobody before you has discovered.
You had to get there by horseback. How isolated is it?
It is very much isolated. In 2012, I got a grant from National Geographic for, especially for this protected area, Puy Puy Protected Forest, which was established, I think, in the mid-80s. But there are no reports. Nobody knows what is living there. Yeah, and I thought, why is that? Yeah, so I got the grant and the money to go there. Then I realized why nobody went there before me, because it's so difficult to get access to it. Yeah, it's practically a rectangular, artificially shaped area in the center of the eastern Andes. Yeah, so it takes like going by car to the next villages are usually in two walking distances from the entrance of the protected area. Yeah, so a combination of cars asking locals with their horses to help you, then you have to walk, not too much fun at very high elevations through rough terrain.
Frogs are usually considered low-level rainforest types of things, but that obviously is not the case. How high up do they go, and what is the climate?
In Peru, the record is close to the snow border.
Wow.
Yeah? This, so close to 5,000 meters.
Pretty interesting for something without much of an internal temperature control.
Exactly. So they are in the challenge, but at this high elevation, the temperature changes are very drastically. So in the daytime, you can have summer temperatures, yeah, and in the night, winter. Yeah, so they have to deal with these drastic changes, and they manage to do so.
How do they do that? I mean, what sort of biochemistry allows them to take the huge fluctuations?
Well, I can comment on their behavior. What they would, for example, do when it gets cold, they would simply hide under stones, and the stone layers there can store the heat. Yeah. So it's actually when you look under stones, often it's not that cold under. Yeah. So they can select temperature level they are comfortable in. When it gets warm, then they can get closer to the sun.
What's their food and what are their predators?
Food are arthropods, yeah, such as insects, for example, spiders, whatever fits usually in a mouth of a small frog.
And their predators?
Predators, for this it hasn't been studied, but there can be snakes. Yeah, of course, the snakes do not get reach such high elevations, but at slightly lower, there are snakes. It can be birds. Yeah, that feed on them, or large spiders, for example. Yeah.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Edgar Lehr about a new frog. He's from Illinois Wesleyan University. Do we know how many of these there are? Are there likely to be, and what their range is?
So we found this new species inside and outside the protected area, I think in total from 9 different places that we have mapped. And we do not know how far more this distribution goes into the protected area or out of the other border of this protected area. It's unknown, but usually amphibians from high elevations have a relatively small distributional area simply because of the borders that can be other mountains or deep valleys. Yeah, so usually they're very restricted, or more restricted distributional areas the higher one is in the Andes. Yeah.
Why is it important for us to keep knowing these things, to keep reaching out for the micro differences in taxonomy that we're looking at?
Yeah, amphibians are often termed like the canaries of the coal mines because they respond very sensitively towards changes in our environment. And when we see amphibians disappearing, and this is something that happens worldwide now, it's very scary, and we should be very much alarmed as humans to change then something, yeah, to kind of prevent them from dying out. And this has been observed even in protected areas that amphibians are dying. We only can protect what we actually know. Yeah? And the more we know, the better we can protect it.
Yeah. We've heard about, in the popular media, we've heard about those amphibian die-offs, but we also heard about parthenogenic development of amphibians, too. Were there odd sex-linked traits that you noticed at this altitude in these populations?
There's nothing known from high elevations that are one has observed, like malformations within frogs, nothing known.
When are you going back?
I go back actually next Monday. Yeah, it was a spontaneous idea because I'm on a sabbatical. Now I'm kind of flexible to travel and to do research. And I thought, I want to go back to Peru, so I go next week for 2 weeks.
What are you looking for then?
I will go to Lima to the Natural History Museum. My collaborators there for since nearly 20 years, and I will revise specimens in the collection. I will meet several colleagues and friends and work with new species.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. We've been talking with Edgar Lehr of Illinois Wesleyan University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.